Good morning, everybody, and welcome to our weekly radio teleconference. I apologize for the little glitches we've had this morning, but we'll get this all ironed out for the future. Before I start with my comments about what's happening here, I'd like to make an announcement. I will be hosting an iTown Hall meeting to discuss the new farm bill. The meeting's going to be held on Wednesday, August 6th, and will begin at 7 p.m. Mountain Time, 6 p.m. Pacific Time, and it will last about 90 minutes. I'm going to be joined in this iTown Hall meeting by Don Dixon, who is the State Director for the USDA Farm Service Agency, by Jeff Burwell, the State Conservationist with USDA NRCS, or Natural Resources Conservation Services, and Mike Field, who is the State Director for USDA Rural Development. Anybody who wants to sign up and be a part of the iTown Hall meeting can do so. It's very easy. All you need to do is to go to my website at http://crapo.senate.gov and then sign up to be called and be a part of the iTown Hall meeting. This week in the Senate, the entire focus of the debate is again on energy. We're having a very contentious debate in this context, however, because the Democratic leadership has put a bill on the floor that just deals with one topic, namely the futures markets, and will not allow the Republicans to have a robust series of amendments to debate other issues. And as we are starting to get reports from the Commodities Futures Trading Commission and the Secretary of Treasury and the President's Working Group on the futures markets, it turns out that although there was some belief that speculation in the markets was causing some of the rise in oil, the reality is being verified by these agencies that there, in fact, isn't any manipulation that they can determine in any significant way of the markets, and that the cause of the rise in fuel prices is a function of supply and demand in the marketplace globally. And that being said, that just brings back all the more pressure for Congress to engage in a broad-based, diversified, comprehensive approach to our energy policy rather than just trying to have a rifle shot solution, particularly one that's not aimed at the problem. I'm very concerned that the United States is far too dependent on petroleum as our source of primary energy, and that in that context, we are far too dependent on foreign sources of petroleum. We need to diversify our energy policy and move into more renewable and alternative fuels. We need to have a much stronger focus on nuclear power and, frankly, a strong conservation effort to try to reduce the amount of oil that we consume. But while we are moving to a more diverse energy policy, we also need to recognize that for several decades at least, we will still have a major reliance on petroleum. And because of that, it's important for us to engage in our own production. We have sufficient potential oil reserves in the United States to literally become energy independent, but we must make the decision to engage in our own production. With that, let me stop and throw it open. And first on the list today is Jason.
Good morning. Go ahead, Jason. I guess the question I wanted to ask was about some legislation you and Max Baucus had brought about changing the way the federal excise taxes are on sporting businesses, firearms and ammunition.
Yes.
I wanted to ask you about that, particularly for ATK here in Lewiston.
Well, federal law requires that manufacturers of sporting arms and ammunition pay excise taxes into the Pittman-Robertson Wildlife Restoration Fund. Many people don't realize that the hunters and fishers and the fishermen and all of those who are engaged in these kinds of activities in the United States pay a tremendous amount of money into these wildlife restoration funds that provide the resources for habitat restoration and other efforts to help wildlife under the North American Wetlands Conservation Act. However, the firearms manufacturers are treated differently than other related businesses, and that they are required to pay federal taxes every 2 weeks. And the legislation that I have entered into with Senator Baucus from Montana amends the Internal Revenue Code of 1986 to require quarterly instead of biweekly tax payments. And the reason for this is that a similar tax scheduling change was enacted 4 years ago for the archery industry, and it resulted in an increase of nearly $15 million in revenue to the fund. Switching to a quarterly excise tax payment system allows our manufacturers to reinvest funds into researching and developing new products and to purchase new machinery and potentially increase marketing. So this is simply, it's a matter of fairness in equal and even-handed treatment, but it's also one that I think is going to result in much more investment in the industry and, in the end, a greater return of revenue to the Wildlife Restoration Fund.
All right, thank you.
You're welcome. Next is Dave Plourd.
Good morning, sir.
Good morning, Dave.
Yesterday we got a news release talking about the that you were working to seek presidential input on health care reform.
Yes.
Could you talk about that a little bit? How are you going to bring these guys together?
Well, as you might guess, it's going to be difficult to bring folks together, particularly in a presidential election year like this. But a group of us, a bipartisan group of us in the Senate, have been working for some time to try to find a consensus-based approach to resolving our health care problems in this country. Because right now, with the driving costs of Medicare and the increasing costs of health care across the board, we are seeing tremendous pressures on the family budgets and on the federal budget as health care costs just continue to rise out of control. If nothing's done, they are literally going to consume the federal budget, and that's the same thing that they're doing in family budgets. So seven Republicans and seven Democrats, actually six Democrats and one independent, Joe Lieberman, have gotten together, and we have agreed to come together across party lines and try to find those kinds of consensus-based solutions that will work for America, rather than just continuing to engage in the partisan battling that's going on over whether we should socialize our Medicare, our medical system, or whether we should move to a totally pure market-oriented system. I personally would prefer to move to a market-oriented system, but the bottom line is we've got to find some consensus-based solutions. We've put together a bill that does focus on market-oriented solutions, and we have recently sent a letter to both Senator Obama and Senator McCain, simply advising them of our effort to find bipartisan solutions to move forward, and encouraging them to ask their chief economic advisors and health care advisors to begin working with our coalition, so that whoever is elected president, we can work together in trying to stop the issue of healthcare from being, from basically becoming yet again one of the victims to the partisan battles that are taking place so regularly here in Washington now.
What are your odds?
Anybody who's followed the debate on healthcare would have to recognize that the odds of this succeeding are let me just put it this way, it's an uphill battle. But frankly, every effort to have a comprehensive major reform of our healthcare system is going to face strong odds against it. That being said, I think that we have built the core of a consensus-based foundation of senators that has a better chance at achieving some kind of a balanced compromise than any other proposal or endeavor that is now in play. To have 14 senators, to have it evenly balanced like we have, and to have them committed to a basic core focus on looking at a market-oriented solution in terms of providing insurance to every American and making an avenue for insurance available for every American is a very, very big first step. I should make one other point. There are a number of other senators who are very interested in this who are not yet co-sponsors. But we have a rule, and that is we only allow sponsors to join up by twos, one Republican and one Democrat, so that we keep it evenly balanced and continue that message of bipartisanship. And so as we move forward, I expect we will see more senators join, but you will continue to see this effort be bipartisan and balanced. All right, next let's go to Leslie.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Last week we were talking about the housing bill bailout that was still in the House.
Right.
And you were very much opposed to it, but since then it moved into the Senate and it was passed. Were there any compromises in the legislation before the vote that made it more palatable?
Well, I wouldn't say there were compromises, but there was a development that ultimately caused me to vote for the bill, even though it had some very significant negatives in it. The bill that we had in the Senate that went over to the House and then ultimately came back to the Senate, I voted against as it left the Senate. And I was very concerned about the essentially new tax on homeowners in the housing fund that was established in the bill. And I'm still very concerned about that. And in fact, I'm going to work to try to eliminate that from our policy. However, between the time when the bill left the Senate and went to the House and then came back to the Senate, it became evident that Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac were potentially going to collapse. I think either Fannie or Freddie had lost 70 or 80% of the value of its stock in a dramatic decline. And the confidence in these two major housing agencies was literally sliding away worldwide. And if they were to have collapsed, then it would have sent ripples through the United States economy that would have brought down many, many more industries and potentially would have driven us into a deep recession, even potentially as deep as the type of recession that we saw in 1929. And because of that major threat to our economy, our Secretary of Treasury came forward with the chairman of the Federal Reserve System with a proposal to include in the housing bill a short-term 18-month fix, meaning a protection of Fannie and Freddie by federal backing, which was also something that I'm very concerned about. But it became evident to me that we had to do that, that if we did not give the world the message that the United States would not allow Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac to collapse, that we would have seen literally a devastating impact to the United States economy. And so in the end, I ended up voting for it because we needed to make that fix. But the compromise was that we put an 18-month sunset on those Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac's provisions so that we don't have to literally have the federal government becoming that involved in housing, the housing economy on a long-term basis. It's a very, very difficult decision that had to be made. I still believe there are some very negative parts and some very positive parts in the bill that we passed, but the bottom line is our economy is very shaky right now, and hopefully this legislation will provide some stability there while our economy regains its footing.
And where is all this money coming from?
Well, there's two pieces of this. Actually, there's three pieces of this. But the two major pieces are, first, the funding for the housing fund, which will be utilized to assist distressed mortgages, will come from Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac themselves. But what that really means is that it will come from mortgage holders, from new home buyers who will pay a little bit higher either interest rate or points on their mortgage in order to provide the funding for stabilizing the market. And that's one of the pieces that I very strongly disagreed with. But that's where that funding will come from. With regard to the backing of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac themselves, that will be a protection from the United States Treasury. It will not necessarily ever have to be utilized. And in fact, the hope is that the mere fact that the United States states that it will back Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac with liquidity funding will cause enough stability for Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac not to ever have to need that backing. And so far, the reaction in the markets has been just that. We've seen some significant stabilization already. We hope to see that stabilization become much more solid. And if that happens, then the federal treasury will not have to provide any support for Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. If they do provide that support to Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, it will be in the form of either a loan or a purchase of equity interest, so the federal government would in the end be paid back or have an ownership asset that it can sell to return those funds to the Treasury.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Any other questions? Bill's not with us today, so...
Senator, I have one more if you have time.
Go ahead, Dave.
The Post Register editorialized a couple of weeks ago about at least implying that if you wanted a position on the Appropriations Committee, you could probably get it. I guess the question is, A, is that true? And B, why are you not interested?
Well, first of all, it's not true. The appropriations seats that go out in the Senate on the Republican side right now are not done by seniority unless there are a multiple number of them, and then every other one goes out by seniority. And so the first answer is that it's not a clear thing that it could happen. But secondly, there are two major committees in the Senate. One is the Appropriations Committee. The second is the Finance Committee, which most people actually believe is a much more powerful committee than the Appropriations Committee, even though the two sort of compete. The Appropriations Committee spends the money. That's its primary function. The Finance Committee handles all of the entitlement programs, which would include obviously health care, Social Security, and so forth, the entire tax code, so all of the tax policy in the country, all of trade policy in the country, and a number of other issues. And I do sit on the Finance Committee. If I were to try to move to the Appropriations Committee, I would have to give up that finance seat. And there are very few people who would think that that would be the right move to make. I've got some significant seniority on the Finance Committee built up now, and am moving up the chain there. And to try to leave at this point, I think would be a mistake.
Okay, very good, sir. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. All right. Any other questions? All right. Thank you very much. We'll talk next week.
Thank you.